Okay, my name is Paul Boyle. I live in Kenya. However, I work in 12 countries in Africa. And my specialty is psychological trauma, where I do training and also do therapy work.
It's kind of obvious, but could you talk a bit about why working in the field of trauma is so relevant to the refugee experience?
I actually worked in a displaced camp in Khartoum for a number of years, burying the dead, feeding the hungry, caring for the poor, and I myself became traumatized. I developed a severe PTSD. So I eventually decided to dedicate my life to heal others from PTSD because I had it myself. Of course, I've overcome it. I've healed myself, got help from others, and I actually founded a program called Healing the Healers, A New Hope for Africa. So this is why I'm here at this conference, because you find that many of the clinicians, the carers, the doctors, they get affected. And so the affected infect and the infected affect. So I'm here to help them make sense of the nonsense that results from PTSD.
Right. So just a little bit of your backstory, because you've got a pretty interesting life journey, I think, that people would be interested in hearing about.
So I was a Catholic priest for 20 years, living in war, conflict. I've experienced arrest, kidnapping, shot. Even my plane has been bombed. I've been working, really. I always tell people I never go to hell because I've been there. And so working as a priest, I think, quite effective. But then after 20 years of service, I realized serving others was wonderful, but what do I need to do for myself? And it was part of my journey of healing myself. You know, I had to focus on myself before considering others. And it was the opposite for 20 years. So I eventually left. I never left a priesthood, but I left my congregation. I still consider myself a priest, but nowadays I call myself a roaming Catholic. So I move around, I work with Muslims and Jews and Hindus and various Christian communities, and that's my ministry now, to bring healing to others.
What do you remember about how the PTSD manifested itself in you?
One of the things that made me, believe it or not, work very hard. So I lost a lot of balance. So I was working 15, 16 hours a day because I was working among 300,000 desperate people. So it made me overwork. Sometimes, often I wouldn't sleep. A little bit paranoid at times, nervous, overeating, sometimes drinking a bit more than I should. So I started realizing I was on the edge, very edgy. And even at one stage, on two occasions, I was chased like 100 miles an hour with security forces pointing AK-47s in at me. And I remember that time I said, I know what I have to do. I need to buy a gun. I need to shoot these guys. And this is why we end up homicidal, suicidal, because when we are traumatized, we have this fight or flight response. Or eventually we end up this freeze response, fight, flight, or freeze. And so for me, what I realized, I was no longer coping. I was no longer balanced. I was no longer stable, no longer happy, no longer fulfilled. And so I was being pushed more and more to the edge, to basically breaking point.
So we're going to talk about caring for the carers, but just talk a little bit about your observations about PTSD in your work in refugee camps and how that informs what sort of therapies you put in place for carers.
Okay, well, you have to look at what is the result of people with PTSD. You know, one of the first things is people self-medicate. So there's an increase of alcohol abuse, drug abuse, spouse abuse, child abuse, sex abuse. So a lot of people end up searching for coping mechanisms. So a lot of the clients who come to me, one of the first things they've lost is their faith. I mean, faith in themselves. They no longer trust themselves. They no longer trust others. If they had any form of religious faith, that's also out the window. And so the basic coping skills they had in the past, like family, friends, faith, you know, whatever, that's out the window. So they get replaced by non-effective means. For example, when we, or the brain says threat, fear, and danger, and people with PTSD are constantly surrounded with memory, threat, fear, and danger, what actually happens is the brain will produce hormones, cortisol and adrenaline, for example, that makes you fight or flight. Now, what's very interesting is the coping mechanisms people use, like alcohol or drugs, smoking, coffee, whatever, they actually produce the same hormones as stress. So when we're working with people with PTSD, we have to even be aware of what they eat, what they drink, what they do, because it actually increases their levels of stress. You know, if I'm with a client, I never ask them, what happened to you? I don't need to know. And this is one of the weaknesses sometimes we have in therapy. We want to know the story. But for me, I don't want to really know the story, because if you ask them to talk about what happened, first of all, they may not remember because there's memory loss. Secondly, they may get nightmares, flashbacks, intrusive thoughts, and you actually increase the levels of stress. What I do ask my clients is, as a result of your experience, how does it affect you today? You know, and those symptoms today, nightmares, anger, aggression, alcoholism, whatever, name them, claim them, and tame them.
So you're going to be speaking with practitioners, people who are in healthcare, who provide healthcare services to people from the refugee experience. What sort of things do you think they're going to bring up with you, just as they go around the room and kind of introduce themselves?
Particularly clinicians, doctors, they often don't understand why refugees have so many physiological problems. And you see, what we need to understand is that 80%, it is known, it is said, it is believed, 80% of physical illness is mental. Now, when we get stressed, we need to understand that one of the first things it switches off is your digestive system. Because when you're faced with threat, fear, and danger, you don't want to eat. So people with long-term stress have long-term digestive problems. People will have low immunity. Because another thing that switches off very soon when you are stressed is your immune system. So you get people coming to doctors with biological problems, immunological problems, digestive problems, maybe even ulcers, irritable bowel syndrome, whatever, all sorts of things. And the doctors, they're saying, well, what's the root of this? But then you find a lot of people developing a lot of pain. They do x-rays and blood tests, and they don't find any source. And that's why they have a lot of clients who have a lot of problems and they don't know the source. And if you don't know the source, you may not know the solution. So I try to help doctors to think out of the box. You know, this may be a stress-related problem as opposed to, just a normal physical problem where people have, you know, cancers and diabetes and whatever. But by the way, people who are in long-term stress, particularly with PTSD, may even develop diabetes, cancers, because the immune system goes down. So I somehow help doctors think out of the box a little bit and to ask different questions. Not so much what's wrong with you, but what is your life experience? So look more at the experience as opposed to the sickness.
If you just joined us, I'm talking with Paul Boyle, and we're here because it's the occasion of the 4th National Refugee Health Conference here in Rochester. Paul, we're talking about your work helping clinicians and healthcare providers understand the impact of trauma on refugees. How does what you suggest change their practice?
Okay, I think one of the weaknesses in our Western healthcare system, if someone has a sickness, we got to fix it. How do we fix it? Medication. You know, medication is not the answer to many of these people. Let's say, for example, it is said that people, like a vast majority of people who are depressed, the medications don't work. Why don't they work? For example, let's say a woman is raped. For sure, one of the hormones involved in people are stressed is serotonin. Serotonin it makes us feel good. It gives us the good feel factor. And people in long-term stress, or people who have been violated, sexually violated, for example, they're in long-term stress, and for sure, their serotonin levels will dip. That will create depression. Now, you can go to a clinician, whether you're a refugee or whoever, even anyone from the United States of America, you've got depression, you'll be given an antidepressant, which is actually a serotonin boost. Now, the question is, will it take away your depression? It will not, because what's alive in that person is the memory. And this is why nowadays we're talking about medication needs to be accompanied with CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. So even the doctors, they are not able to give the whole answer to people. So like someone, especially the refugees who have come from horrific backgrounds, they will definitely get depressed. They may also get depressed because of the seasonal changes, or something called the seasonal affective disorder. You know, less sunshine, staying at home, it's dark, it will also create depression. Now, is the answer a tablet, I think the answer is much more. So this is why the doctors need to work with people like me, the counselors, the therapists, the psychologists, and even the psychiatrists. We need to work together to give a more comprehensive treatment plan, especially for refugees who've come from horrific backgrounds.
And then in terms of supporting the care providers, how open are those practitioners to actually acknowledging that they themselves are perhaps being affected by the trauma that they're seeing in the patients?
This is the hard part. I've experienced a lot of clinicians who have developed burnout, breakdown, not coping. And one of the reasons is they enter the darkness of their clients or their patients by saying, "What happened to you? Tell me your story." And when I'm working with clinical psychologists or counselors or therapists or whatever, I always say, never enter into someone's darkness. Because if you do, you get surrounded and engulfed by their darkness. And so this is why you find many of our clinicians feel bad, sorry, you know, this is terrible, they're affected by that story or event. So the idea is not to enter the darkness, the idea is to throw in light. You enlighten the client of their condition as opposed to enter their story, enter their pain, enter their hurt, because you find that many clinicians develop what we call vicarious traumatization, secondary trauma. Hence, clinicians need to develop insight. Insight to what's happening in them. You know, how am I being affected? Am I being disturbed? If so, take a step back so that they can actually ensure that they're effective clinicians for their clients.
Right. How flexible are... We know that medicine is a big business and that there are very strong business models that drive a lot of service delivery. Part of that would be time, I would imagine, some of the things you're talking about. You know, maybe you're not going to get them all into that 15-minute consultation. Is that a challenge?
You know, in the United States, time is money and money is time. So it's a business. People want to earn. There's high demands. But I found here at Rochester General Hospital, especially working with Jim Sutton, he has various people from the refugee community who are translators for the doctors. Now, I have actually worked with these translators, helping them to be healed, helping them to overcome their traumas, helping them to be safe. So in a sense, that translator is a very important person, because it depends what you say to the doctor. You know, emotions can be transferred to a doctor. So these translators were working with Jim Sutton at Rochester General Hospital. They're actually equipped to deal with other people's trauma. And so in a sense, they are even a buffer. They're a buffer zone to the doctor. So they can actually even diminish the effects of the trauma onto the doctor. Second thing is, these translators, for example, are very important people because they actually follow up. You know, a doctor might say to one of his clients, you need to go and see a psychologist, you need a psychotherapy, you need cognitive behavioral therapy, you need to have a meeting with a psychologist or whoever. And that translator is the one who may accompany them, you see, follow up. Because otherwise doctors, you know, in, out, it must have an effect on them. And I really would highly recommend those very, very, very busy doctors, they need to take time off, time out, so that they can actually reflect on what's going on in them. And that's the insight. But there's a second word that people really need to develop. Doctors and clinicians need to develop foresight. When they actually see, I am being affected, take a step back. But we end up, it's too late, we're already in the middle of the crisis. And so it affects you, your relationships, your marriage, your practice, and then people end up in the burnout and the breakdown stage.
Right. And we know this is something that's being acknowledged, that there's very high levels of drug abuse, alcohol abuse, self-harm amongst the medical community because of the kind of stress factors that you're talking about. So it's not just in their relationships, say, with refugee communities. I would suggest you seem to be saying that there's also the need for these sort of strategies to be put in place more generally.
Well, I once read an article in the UK. They found that they looked at professions of people who had cirrhosis of the liver, alcohol induced, and they found that doctors were in the top 10. Clergy were in the top 10. Lawyers and, just like yourself, journalists. High levels of stress. Not coping, not managing. If you don't deal with your stress will deal with you. If you don't manage it, it'll manage you. If you don't control it, it'll control you. If you don't sort it out, it's going to sort you out. And that's exactly what I help clinicians do. They deal with their stress. And when they deal with it, they're healthy, balanced, and stable.
Couple of final things, Paul. Working up refugee practitioners who are also able to, you mentioned, working with translators. I imagine that's kind of key, that you have people who are able to develop those skills, who are parts of those communities and are able to kind of provide consistent delivery of those kinds of strategies in their own communities.
You know, doctors can't work alone. I would even encourage every doctor not only to have these people like the translators, but to have healthy, balanced people from the refugee community. Because there's a lot of healthcare issues in refugee communities, and really nobody knows how to tackle it. I would also encourage even these clinicians, they should have two rooms. They should have a room for themselves, especially if you're working with refugees, and there should be a counselor's room next door. You will find 80% of physical illness is mental. These people have emotional problems, social problems, connection problems, being far from their culture, trying to settle, not coping. I even had, the last time I came to this conference, in one particular community in the United States in the previous 12 months, over 30 people from that community committed suicide. They were all elderly, in their 70s and 80s, because they were not able to cope. When we think of health, we should not just think of body. We need to think of mind, body, and soul. Soul is about spirit, it's about relationships, because people get affected in relationships. And so, you know, I think we need to be a little bit more comprehensive in the way that we treat people in the United States, particularly among the refugee community.
So final thing, as refugee families and communities integrate into existing communities in the United States, what do you think average people can do if they're spending time with a refugee family that's moving into their community or that's opening a store, or just things that they can be aware of that come out of your own experience of working with people with trauma?
You know, the refugees, they come from communities that's very warm, very welcoming, very caring, very patient. And sometimes we're not so good with a refugee, you know, because we say, I don't speak their language, I don't know their culture, I don't know why these women are dressed the way they are. You know, we tend to already adopt an attitude of, I don't understand. I think in order to welcome the refugee, we need to try to understand. You just, welcome, how are you? You know, try to get to know them, try to accommodate them. Because there's a lot of things in their culture that are very alien to here, you know? And this gentle outreach, this wanting to understand, this wanting to take an interest, just even caring and supporting. And because you will find that this country is even built on the refugee community, the Irish, the Italians, and God knows whoever, you know. And they have settled and they have built this country. The refugees that come in 2014, they're the future builders of this country. You have to welcome them. Let them build. Let them be part of it. Let them be part of the United States of America. And it will be incredible what these people are able to offer. But they need to be welcomed and accepted and also appreciated.
Thank you, Paul. Been great to talk to you.
Thank you. You're welcome.